Well, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, sitting here with my new best friend, Ben Tanzer, expecting to do the After Hours show, but we're also watching the very end of the very exciting Super Bowl, so you can listen to the radio and you can watch TV. Would that be your recommendation, Ben?
Pass in slow motion. I thought, okay, maybe it'll just end before I have to sprint from the bus to the studio.
The other thing, I've been out on Super Bowl days before, and it still stuns me, given the astonishing hype of the Super Bowl, that there literally is anybody. There are people out on the streets.
Well, they are.
And you think to yourself, at least I do, I think, wow, these people may have more interesting lives than I do. Do you know what I mean?
Well, we went to the zoo today, so... There were people at the zoo also. So even on the day of the Super Bowl, people want to see the hyenas.
Good. Ben is a terrifically prolific writer. Be Cool is his 5th book.
Maybe fifth sounds good.
Fifth published book.
Yes, that sounds right. I know. I don't know if you count the ones sitting in the drawers at home or not.
You have to.
Okay,
you have to because they may be published one day.
Maybe it's my 100th book.
He also does a podcast called This Podcast Will Change Your Life. He also teaches. He also performs at various places. What fascinated me, I met Ben at a podcast festival about a couple months ago, and he gave me a copy of Be Cool, and I've devoured it and think it's fabulous. And then we met at the Billy Goat, which is really the way you get to meet people. And we had a lovely, wonderful, long talk. And I want you to tell the listeners some of what you told me that night. I mean, you didn't come among this whole 45 minutes, I think, is going to be, I think, about creativity and what drives a person to be creative. You did not really start writing seriously until you were in your 30s, right?
That's true. The story I didn't tell you, which is probably very boring, is that I have told it elsewhere. Around my 30th birthday, I had spent maybe 10 years, minimally, sort of journaling and saying, I got to start writing. I would literally write, I have to start writing. And right before my 30th...
That's some fascinating journal.
And let me tell you, I know, it's both very boring and, as it turns out, not very inspirational. But I woke up quite literally around my 30th birthday... And I remember sort of lying in bed thinking, okay, work is going well. You know, I've worked as in day jobs and nonprofits for, 25 years.
What sort of day jobs?
For many years, I worked at Prevent Child Abuse America. That's my longest running job. So working with the chapters around the country and then on communications there and messaging. It's really the area of specialty of mine now. And, working around prevention issues and brain development, all sorts of important work.
What drew you to that?
You know, it's funny. I'm not quite sure. There is something about prevention I'm very drawn to. I'm very drawn to science. I'm no scientist, and if you talk to me for more than 2 minutes, you'll know that. But I like the idea that people were figuring out how prevention works, how the brain works, the impact of child abuse, all those things I got very caught up in.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, they actually have some ideas about how to stop that now. And as soon as that came up for me, and as soon as I saw you could sort of as we say, reframe it in a positive way that if we do this, then it'll lead to this. Then I started thinking, this is the kind of work I want to be around, how you change lives.
You know, it's interesting. My memory is never really very good from memories from the Billy Goat. But your mother was a psychotherapist, right?
Right.
And your dad was an artist.
Yeah, it's an interesting combination.
But I think it's really helped guide you in some genetic way, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, on so many levels. I mean, first off, they're also both activists. So I grew up in a very lefty,
in New York,
aggressive
right?
house, upstate New York. Yeah, central New York. They were both from the Bronx. My dad was an artist and was constantly talking about everything. He was a high school dropout who had written a dissertation in his head on every possible topic in the world.
Yeah, he sounds like
he was great. And then you had my mom, who is amazing. I hope she's listening wherever she is. And, she was a trained psychotherapist. And so we had to talk about every dream at breakfast. And you could never say, I think that's cool or I like that. She'd always say, well, why? Why? What do you think? And then you give an answer and she'd say.
So it's kind of an analytical childhood, right?
Nonstop. Everything had. And as a kid, I hated it. As an adult, I love it. But it's very good. It's funny. In a way, it doesn't just prepare you to be creative. It prepares you to try to do, I think, interesting work in interesting places because people never want to settle for it because that's cool. Maybe that works. But
yeah.
I haven't been in one of those offices. So I've spent a lot of my life with someone saying, okay, that's a good policy. I appreciate your argument, but why do we want to do it? And then you'd say, well, because it'll save lives. And they say, but how will it save lives? And you'll give that example. And then they'll say, I don't know if I understand that. What's the science? And I think with my parents and the way they were, I've always been very caught up in trying to figure out those narratives around science and prevention and why things work and why they don't work.
How did your father as a visual artist influence you then, too? I mean, about the whole notion of there's a big sacrifice to anybody in joining the so-called creative world. What did he tell you about that?
It's funny because a lot of times I'll say something, my mom will say, you sound like your father. And I'll say, he said that? And then she'll say, were you not paying attention? Like, I don't know that I fully appreciated it when I was in it, but I think what you see for certain is the sort of drive. Like, my mom, I don't think I realized this till now. I thought he didn't always want to hang out with us, not in a negative way, just he had other things to do. And I later learned that my mom sort of gave him Saturday every weekend because he would paint for the entire day.
Wow.
Even though he was more or less painting Monday through Friday, but Saturday was like the sacred day. I think one thing you see, even though I didn't probably care when I was my kid's age, was that he was always trying to figure out things and how they worked and how they fit together. And he had these sort of, he would never use this language, like mashups. Like one day you'd be sitting there and he'd say, you know, Isaac Bashoff Singer. And I'd say, yeah, of course, Bashoff Singer. I've read him. My dad would say, I'm trying to figure out how to do a painting where I sort of merge his ideas and the Buddha's. And you'd say, and he's like, you know what I mean? And I'd be like, well,
no, I don't know.
I was like, I don't know what you mean. So it was this constant, he was a very curious guy. And both my parents are incredibly curious. And that to me had played a very big role. But again, I didn't get started. I was like an athlete. You know, the way you rebelled in my house growing up was you had to be a jock and like super all American, which I'm sure I failed at equally. But, you know, my house, you had to, you know, there was no curfew. So, you know, to rebel in the house, you had to like follow the rules.
Did they impose any kind of aspirations on you? Like, we want you, beside being a jock in high school, but we want you to.
No. It's very funny. I think my mom actually regrets that a bit, though. I believe she's proud of me. But they really didn't function like that. And, you know,
it doesn't sound like that.
My mom will also say that I was very self-sufficient from a very young age. And they also were very arm's length with me. Like, he'll figure it out. My brother, though, is very funny. He has a PhD. He is the smart one.
In what?
And the taller one. Counseling psychology. Hmm. And he will say, didn't you feel an obligation to get a PhD? Didn't that seem like one of the rules of the house? And, you know, when they say kids grow up in different houses, I'm like, no, never.
No.
Never had any sense that was important. I mean, he's the Ivy Leaguer. He's got the PhD. He's a brilliant, awesome guy. But it's very funny. He had a very different feeling growing up than I did. I was very removed, though.
I know that you, because we shared stories, I know you love Chicago. What brought you to Chicago in the first place?
I had this idea that I wanted to live in as many big cities as possible after growing up in a small one. So I had lived in San Francisco and I'd lived in New York City. And Chicago seemed like, to me, the next great city, though I had never been here.
Yeah.
I also, which is a little more embarrassing, my friends and I, my wife, we all sort of hated where we went to undergrad, though we're all still friends. And it didn't look like a college to me. It looked very boring. And I had this idea I should go somewhere really gothic and epic looking. That was part of the path I was going to be on. And when I got a look at University of Chicago, I thought, I have to try to get in there for anything.
Yeah.
And then I realized, which is very dopey, that if I got into school there, I could also live here. And that was it. I didn't really know very much. I mean, I had associations like you and I talked about.
Sure.
Studs Terkel in my house growing up was a god.
A god, sure.
And, you know, again, very lefty. And, you know, my grandfather, even more progressive than my parents. And his father was a union organizer.
Chicago is one of the great labor towns. Was, and has a history of being one of the great
labor towns. I had all those associations. And I don't know. It's funny. People talk about all these, you know, especially New Yorkers. It's like, and I am one. Where is it? What is it? Why go there? And I was the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I did say, where is it? Because I had no idea. But
when
I
did
really
you, before we take
it.
A little break, when did you, when and where did you meet your wife?
I met her freshman year in college, and I may have told you this story.
I want you to share your stories with
my children. Hate this story. I saw a woman with long dark hair and very long legs exercising in the basement of our dorm, and I said, I've got to meet whoever looks like that. And they just didn't have women like that where I grew up. And about a month later, I met her in a completely different circumstance, and we weren't even being introduced. And I thought, oh, my God, that's the woman from the basement. And then I was dogged about trying to have a conversation with her.
And it's worked out. You got two kids.
20-odd years later.
And you're happy. Ben Tanzer is a writer. He's a podcaster. He is a thinker. And we'll continue on with him after a couple commercials. Ben Tanzer, my guest, and I were just talking about, even though it's my story about a remarkable photographer, poet, outdoorsman, everything, arguably the first Japanese-American photojournalist in the country. Ben Tanzer is the author of 5 books. He has other books, I think, sitting in drawers somewhere at his home that he lives in the near north side within easy walking distance of 5 Faces, which is one of his favorite restaurants. He lives with his wife and 2 teenage.
One almost teenage. One teenage and one.
Miles and Noah. Yes. How old are they?
Miles is 15 and Noah's 11.
What do they think you do?
I think
if their kid, if some kid at school says, "Hey, what's your dad do?" What would they say?
I think they would say he does something with nonprofits and he's a very unsuccessful author.
Why would they?
Then
say
they would pause and they would say, and he yells a lot. I don't know. For years, Miles would say, I think I told you this, we'd run into someone randomly somewhere and they'd say, "Are you the author?" Or, "I just got your book." Sometimes.
Yeah.
But no matter what, he'd always say, "You know, he's not very successful, though." He always had to throw in that little dig, which I thought was great. My mom was like, "Isn't he being rude?" I'm like, "I think it's kind of funny and not inaccurate. Let's give him credit. He knows where to probe."
In your 30s, what is the catalyst for taking that journal and those journal entries that consisted of, "I think I should be a writer. I want to write something. I think I should write something now."
So I wake up. That's right. We started telling that story. And I'm lying there next to my wife, and it's a weekend. And I'm about a year or so out of grad school, and I'm about a year or so married. And I'm like, "Wow, this marriage thing is going really well. I'm really enjoying it." I had never had any plans to get married. And I thought, "Wow, this work thing's going really well. I'm really enjoying it.
I really like the city."
I love Chicago. And then I rolled over, and I thought, "I should be happier." That was the catalyst. I thought, "I should be happy." Like, if all
that
of this
always would please a wife. Yeah,
I know, right? I didn't share that with her at the time. But I thought, "I should be happier." And I'm telling you, it hit me. This is so cheeseball, like a thunderbolt. I thought, "It's because I'm not writing." Like, I was just convinced of it.
Wow.
Just convinced. And then this is true. Maybe I didn't just go roll over and get a pen, but a couple of days later, I'd always had this story in my head. Like, I had a bunch of stories that were waiting. Like,
sure.
I would say, like,
sure,
airplanes circling O'Hare. And one of them was about a guy who's going to leave his wife. So this furthers this theme my wife wouldn't want to hear. And then maybe a week later, we get a call from someone my wife knows who's going to leave her husband. And my wife got very upset. But then for some reason, I actually took it very hard. There's something about it. I got very upset, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I thought, "Oh, there's that story about that guy." And this is a true story. I sat down and wrote this story. First story I've ever written in my life. Wrote that story, like, just poured it out onto a piece of paper about this guy. It was literally called Leaving Home. And I wrote it start to finish. It wasn't that long.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking something along the lines of, "Okay, you've started. This is it." And that was it. Once I wrote that story, I've written almost every day since.
What did you do with that story?
Tried to get it published. I don't think that one. I didn't actually get published for a number of years. I probably wrote 4 or 5 years at least without getting a single thing published. But I wrote almost every day.
See, I know a number of people who started their writing careers in that way. I mean, a number of famous Chicago author named Willard Motley, for instance, and the great Bill Granger, too. But once they got published, that act of publication was so empowering. And you didn't seem to need that because you are writing every day, but it's that affirmation. Did you feel that way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it's funny because that story did get accepted by some random journal in Seattle. And then the guy wrote me about a month later. He said, "I'm too ill. I'm too physically ill to put out any more journals. So your story's not going to get published." It was really funny.
Wow.
It was the most and least triumphant moment of my life. But once that first piece got accepted, then I thought, "Well, this is real." And I thought, "I'm going to do this anyway." And what really empowered me and what became, and I think this fits whatever my personality is, that once some pieces start getting picked up, I thought, "Okay, time to write a book." I thought, "Now you have to write a book." And then that became a real fixation of mine.
What was that first book?
First one is called Lucky Man, and it got published, that very first one. And that one, similarly, I got the idea in my head, and I've been carrying around an idea. And I knew what the first page was. I knew what the last page was. And so I blocked out a set of time in my head when I would start, and I would only work on that book. And I poured it out in about 3 months.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And it hasn't been quite like that since. But that first one was almost a download. I don't know if we could download back then. But
yeah, but no, I know in essence it was kind of like
a download.
I was
just primed every word. It was just, it really felt like every word was waiting.
As you progress through Orphans, Lost in Space, The New York Stories, Sex and Death, Do you feel more confident with your own voice with every book, with every, not even every book, but with every piece?
I do. It's probably a two-part, a yes, but it's probably a two-part answer. With the fiction, that's got to be an awkward phrase. When I wrote my second book, it didn't sound quite right. And then I sent it to someone to read, an editor, and he said, "This is actually a very good book," he said, "but it's not a Tanzer book." I don't even know if there was such a thing.
What is that?
I didn't know. I thought, this is kind of a compliment. He said, really? He goes, "Please don't send this to anybody." He goes, "Everything you accomplished with Lucky Man, you've destroyed with this. It's like you're trying to write a popular book." It was really funny. It was devastating. And this is just a guy who loved the first book. I was just trying to get his opinion.
Yeah.
But then I read a review, which sounds so embarrassing, of Lucky Man. Like, someone had read it much later after it came out. And the way they described Lucky Man, I thought, oh, that's what he's trying to say. The first book was so sparse and punchy and electric. This is like long sentences. And so I went back to that book and I stripped out hundreds of words. And I thought, okay, that's what my books are supposed to be like. And ever since then, I always, though I do tons of editing, now I know how to write those. The essays are different. But now with fiction, it's always like strip away, only punchy, only punk, always trying to sound punk.
The latest book, Be Cool, is a gathering of essays. Define for me, in the inimitable Ben Tanzer way, the meaning of essay. What does an essay mean to you?
I think this is, you have some sort of nugget or slice or idea in your head, my head, and I want it to sort of sing in some fashion, that I want to see where it will go. And then the way I usually write essays, they aren't necessarily A to Z. I mean, I have an idea that may be the middle of the essay or the beginning or the end, and I follow wherever my brain goes. You know, there's a piece in there, I wanted to write about violence, I remember, particularly about my son being bullied and my desire for my son to hit this bully, which apparently is
right,
not encouraged right, anymore.
Right.
And then I remember, you know, and I was a fighter, which always cracks up my children. And my dad was a fighter. And so I think I mainly wanted to be a fighter to be like him. And you can see I'm not that big, but I fought a lot. And now I don't. But a couple of years ago, you know, I threatened someone, which I rarely do. I mean, how about never do? And as I started writing about my son, I thought, well, I really have to write about this guy that I threatened, who clearly backed off. But then I had to write about other things, you know, this assault I had. And you know, I got assaulted in New York right near the end of our time there. And I thought, these all hang together. And so an essay to me is, you take one idea, you know, violence or punk music, and then I just try to find all the pieces that come into my head and see how they hang together.
Yeah. We've done a remarkable job in this book, in Be Cool. We'll talk about some specific stories. I should tell you all that the Patriots have won the Super Bowl in overtime.
Oh, my God.
And I'm pretty sure this game will go down as, well, it certainly will go down as the greatest comeback in the history of the Super Bowl.
And Tom Brady's probably locked in his greatest quarterback title.
Oh, no question.
Right?
No.
We should add that when I walked out of the house, I think Atlanta was up by 18.
Yeah. No, this is the biggest comeback in the history of the Super Bowl. No question about it. And plus, the great thing, and you'll appreciate this, is Roger Goodell, who kicked Brady out for four games, has got to give him the trophy. He's got to give him the trophy. You started in this crazy writing business when the publishing business itself was becoming unsteady, for lack of a better word. What do you attribute your ability to get published, book after book after book after book after book, in an environment that is not, does not reward young writers the way it used to? I mean, I'd love you to say I'm that good.
Right. No, that probably
will not happen.
But I
know you don't feel that way.
No, not at all. But I think there's probably a couple things. I think one, which I have been very fortunate with, is that there's always been some editor or publisher who wanted to know what I was doing next. I've really benefited from that.
Talk about empowering
and I think there are like a network of writers, a very small one, but who know people. And so my name has been passed along a couple of times, and I can think of like the story behind Orphans, an author I really love, passed my name along to an editor who was moving on to another shop, and that guy sent me a courtesy note, and he said, "Hey, send me some of your books." And I didn't hear from him for like a year.
Yeah.
And then a year later, he's like, "Hey, you know, I read those books. I just never followed up. Let's get drinks."
Wow.
And it became a thing. And so I think, one, there's always been someone who's interested in, what are you doing next? And then I think I've met them, and I believe those conversations have gone well. You know, and if people want to drink and talk about books, I'll drink and talk about books. If they want to go for a run and talk books, like whatever they want to do, I just adapt to the situation. So I think that's really helped. And then, for better or for worse, to your point about being unsteady, you know, I've rarely been able to work with the same publisher twice either.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly.
It remains unsteady. Every book is a bit of a crapshoot. I just keep writing and hoping, you know, and it's a hoping and writing process. And again, though, but I've been lucky. There's someone somewhere, you know, Lost in Space. There was the publisher of Be Cool, found Lost in Space. But I think first he'd heard about me from another writer. And then he said, hey, you have this essay collection. I don't really know it. And I had a copy. I handed him a copy. You always got to have a copy to hand someone.
Yeah, right.
So I handed him a copy. And then I hear from him about a month later. He's like, are there more? What are you doing now? And then we exchanged some emails. And he said, what's going on? Do you have anything else? And I said, well, I've got about 10 essays I've written in relation to Lost in Space. I have about 10 I've sketched out in case someone's interested. And I have 10 I would write only if someone's interested. He goes, why don't we do a book of 30 essays? And so that was maybe 2 years ago. And here it is in front of you coming out this
week.
It
is. You can get all sorts of information about Ben by just putting his name. And I mean, he'll find stuff. But TanzerBen.com.
Right.
TanzerBen.com will give you tons of information. We're going to get a little commercial, then we'll get some news, and Ben and I will carry on. Welcome back to After Hours. The New England Patriots have won what will be called by some sports writers the most exciting Super Bowl in history, Super Bowl 51. Ben Tanzer is here for a few more minutes. His latest book, and you can get all the information about him at TanzerBen, TanzerBen.com, is Be Cool. One of the best essays in here is Ira Glass Wants to Hit Me. Could you pretend you're in a movie producer's office and give me the four sentence, what's this about?
You know, I am a terrible Ira fanboy. That's one sentence. Yeah. I was dying to meet him.
You can
That's
go on.
Two sentences.
Jodie Foster is involved.
She
in
is.
Yes.
She is. I got a... I was able to score an invite just to watch his show, watch it live, and I'm a fan. I love the show. And I really wanted to meet him. And people kept telling me...
Your wife is in this essay, too.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I drag everybody down with
Everybody's
me. If I go
there.
Down, everybody goes down. Even Ira Glass. But this is a long time ago. But I really wanted to meet him. And people kept telling me, oh, when you write nonfiction, it feels like it's on. It could be on that show.
Yeah.
Which apparently is not the case, for the record. But I got to meet him, and he was hanging out with a bunch of people. And I sort of inserted myself into the conversation. And later, my therapist said I was probably trying a little too hard. What phrase did he use? Showing off. Uh-huh. My therapist felt I was showing off. But I inserted myself into the conversation, and he took umbrage. He took umbrage to my comment, though.
He's touchy, man. He can
be touchy. I don't
know
him, yeah. I meant
do.
It as a compliment.
He can
but
be touchy.
He got furious. I mean, absolutely furious. Like, so quickly, which I loved. And then I decided to play along and actually decide. And I knew I was correct with my comment. But I said, you know, you're probably right. I'm probably wrong. And for some reason, that really set him off. And it kept escalating. And he's a lot bigger than I am. And there was a moment where I thought Ira Glass is going to punch me in the face. And I thought, how cool would that be? Hence the Be Cool. But he did not punch me in the face. And then his girlfriend sort of broke it all up. And I never got on the show. But it was a very, very funny moment that apparently I completely mishandled.
Well, it's a very funny piece, too.
Good. Well, I love him.
Another one that we can talk about all the 30-some in here is I'm in love with Mexico City Blues.
Oh, thank you.
Do the same with you're making a pitch.
So Mexico City Blues is a story about a mother who really wants to take maybe one final trip with her sons, not because anyone's sick or ill, but because her two sons, my brother and I, are just getting too old to go travel with their mother. And we go to Mexico, which is her desire. And her plan is to get us, like when we were kids, to see lots of art and then take us to the beach. Now, here we're at this point, we're teenagers, so I'm sure it didn't take her that much work. But we are in Mexico City, which we loved, and things were going poorly. There's a moment where we went to the amateur bullfights,
right?
Which, for the record, is a horror.
Horror,
and
yeah.
A guy literally in the stands next to us sprinted over the fence and killed a bull with a knife out of his pocket because the matador couldn't. I mean, right at our feet. Killed this bull. It was incredible. It was mesmerizing. But later we made the mistake of eating shrimp scampi, which apparently is a water-based product, and we got violently ill in succession.
Yeah.
And my brother got especially ill in the airport as we were trying to get to the beach. And so it's really a story about family and memories. And what I did was, my brother had always said that story was not allowed to be told in public, and here I am telling it. Sorry, Adam. So I wrote him a note, and I said, if I send you the piece, can I get your permission? So he read the piece, and then he wrote me this very funny letter, because he's very funny. So then I put his letter into the piece.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was about a really poorly executed trip, or almost everything wrong, including Adam's almost drowning, which set us back several hours. But he lived.
Do you ever, Ben, have to rein yourself in? You've written a great deal about your kids too, and your wife, and do you find yourself? Do you ever rein yourself in? Because one of the things I like about your writing, especially, is how deeply personal it is. And if it's not true, it's real. And I think take that as high praise.
I appreciate that. Yes, I actually do rein myself in. With the kids, I have a rule of thumb. I did write a whole book about being a father and being the son of a dead father, which wasn't what the publisher asked me to work on. But I thought, I can't write about being a father without acknowledging that my father isn't here and his shadow is long and my kids will never meet him. But my rule with that book was, if it feels like it's one of their secrets, it doesn't get in the book, right? So, and the idea was, I actually had this conversation with my 15-year-old one time. I'm the main character, which sounds very egocentric. So I will always put everything on there when I'm embarrassed about. I don't have any secrets, but your secrets are safe. Now, there's stuff that will embarrass the children. Same with my wife. If it feels like a secret, it's off base. And I did write an essay for Be Cool that I ran by my mother, and I think it's brilliant. I would rarely say that, but this one I loved. But I thought she might be touchy about it, and so I sent it to her, and she said, please don't publish that. So that one's in the vault. So if I am the center of the story, I will put everything on the page. Yeah, I don't mind being embarrassed. Yeah. If I think I'm embarrassed, it's really the four of them are the only people I'm worried about.
Sure.
But again, mostly about secrets. If it's something they protect, then that's not funny.
You also, in the 5 minutes we have left, you also teach a professional development class at Lake Forest downtown.
I do.
That's a fast. How did that happen?
I mean, this is funny. I thought I should try to learn how to teach a college class. I'd never done it.
Yeah.
And so the dean at that school, Davis Schneiderman, who's a terrific writer and someone I'm friendly with, once in a while he would post things about classes. And so I would write him notes and I'd say, you think I could teach that? And he'd be like, no, you're not qualified.
You're totally unqualified.
You've got to leave me alone. But there was something about this class, and possibly they were especially desperate. They needed to fill this position. And I said, I really think I can do this one, unlike all the other ones. And he said, you know, come up with a fake class and let's see how it goes and they'll rate you. So I had like 36 hours to create a class, and it went really well. It was only about 45 minutes. It's a 3-hour class. And the funny part is I really did have a lot of ideas about this topic. I don't know that I have a lot of ideas about every topic, but this one, honestly, like some of these essays, I could see the whole semester in my head. I really could.
Sure.
And he gave me the old syllabus. I don't even sound like a professor. And I thought, this is cool, but this isn't how I would teach it. And they were fine with that. And I think the first semester went really well, kind of like getting something published. And I thought, okay, then I felt emboldened to figure things out. And
you enjoy it.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
no, I don't know that I'm a good teacher, but I think I'm a good air traffic controller. You know,
I get
good speakers and
but it's also the other thing that I think appeals to you is you're getting a chance to introduce some of these young people to this city in a way that they're not seeing it staying in dormitories on campus of Lake Forest College. That seems to really energize you, too.
Well, I love that because a lot of them, you know, they come in. It's cool. It's their loop program. So the students basically move to Chicago for a semester. They have to work. They have to take classes. And so we have a chance. I have a chance to sort of enhance the experience. I mean, some of them, many of them, have never even really been in the city. Or if they've been here, maybe it was like a school field trip to the museum. And so we get to see it. Now, the class is at night. It used to be during the day, so I'm a little more limited where I can sort of drag them around. But they're getting a Chicago experience. And, of course, Chicago is probably one of the best things that's ever happened to me.
Yeah. You have put together a fascinating creative life, because I do think of this college class as an aspect, a facet of your creativity, too. The podcast, in a minute, how long have you been doing that?
Podcast is about 8 years old, and at the time they weren't quite happening yet, and I just became fascinated with it as a medium, and it turned out it wasn't that hard to figure out. I mean,
it's another way, but it's another way for you to, it's another form of self-expression that I think is doing nothing but growing. I mean, that's what I learned at this podcast festival where I met you. You can go, ladies and gentlemen, and learn all about this this prolific creative character, Ben Tanzer, at TanzerBen, TanzerBen.com. Ben, it's an ongoing pleasure to know you and to read you. So you'll come back on. Come back on in the spring and bring the kids.
I would be thrilled. I was so close to getting at least one of them here tonight.
But they'd love it. Elif, don't kids love it in here. They're like, wow, what's this? I mean, there's nothing here except, you know, four of us. And like, wow, look, a TV. That's crazy. So bring them in next time.
I would love to. Absolutely.
I hope to see you soon.
Sure.
Good luck.
Thank you so much for this.
Good luck with everything, man. Good luck with everything. We'll be back in a couple minutes.